Thank you. Thanks to the organizers for inviting me. So I'm going to talk about parabolic optimal transportation equations on closed manifolds, on compact manifolds, no boundary. So this is the main result I'm talking about is going to be joint with Yoon-Han Kim and Jeff Streets. So to start out, we'll just recall the elliptic optimal transport equation. You have two densities and a cost function, and you're trying to pair these, assuming at this point someone should have written this down already. So you have rho bar, the densities you're trying to pair. T is the cost exponential of a gradient function U. And this is going to be on some closed manifold. So we're going to assume the A1 and A2 conditions, the twist and the local twist conditions. And we're going to write down a parabolic optimal transport equation. I guess this equation is assuming, the elliptic equation is assuming these two conditions. The parabolic optimal transport equation is you take UT, so this is going to be the left-hand side. And what we're going to do is take the natural log of this. And I'll tell you why I think that's the natural thing to do. So this is the equation I'm going to study. And I can rewrite this just slightly. Maybe if you look at it in this way, it might seem a little unnatural. The time derivative of u is given by the natural log of the determinant of dt minus the natural log of rho over rho bar. So our main theorem is that this is Kim and Streets. So we have a cost function. So if they let natural log of rho bar, smooth densities. And these are, so we're just saying with respect to some volume form, you can take any metric on the manifold you want. It doesn't really come up at this point. Just take any metric. So this is on a closed M. And closed compact, no boundary. So C is going to be smooth away from a cut locus. Then, and satisfies the A1, A2 conditions. Then, if you also have the MTW curvature of C is bigger than some positive delta, and you have C satisfies the stay away condition, then there exists a unique solution of this equation, which I'll call this optimal transport parabolic. With fix u at 0 to be 0, and so in this, so u exists for all time, and exponentially converges to a solution of elliptic equations. Okay, so I'm not going to talk too much about what these are, as I'm sure someone, or looking at the abstracts, those are going to be discussed or have been discussed. This is positive delta, yeah, positive, strictly, or larger than some delta, which is bigger than zero. Oh, yeah, it's the original MTW condition, the with orthogonality. Okay, well, yeah, I mean, the state wave property in particular is that if the densities, if the natural logs of the densities are bounded, then there's a strict distance away from the cut locus. Yeah, that doesn't depend. Only depends on the bounds, yes, yes. Yeah, it's where, I mean, for everything, I'll just say assume, you can always just assume for the rest of this talk, m equals Sn, c is equal to the distance squared. So yeah, if you happen to find some other cost which is like this. I mean, there are a few other ones which satisfy these nice properties, but for all intents and purposes, you can think of this. Okay, so this is this elliptic or this parabolic equation. I should ask. I'll mention also that so Kitagawa, Jun Kitagawa, worked out for the corresponding problem on for manifolds I guess for the second boundary value problem, it's the Schrödinger-Wong result. So there's a, I mean, they don't have to worry about the state wave property, but if you have some, actually it's a weak, if MTW is non-negative, and then you have regularity for the second boundary problem. So Kitagawa worked out that with the same sort of equation. Yeah, well, yeah, for domains in Rn, I mean, it's if you're familiar with this result, this same result holds. So I should say, why do we study this particular equation? There's many. There's many forms. If you were to say Google parabolic Monge-Ampère equations, you would probably not find this one. I haven't actually found it. So usually, parabolic Monge-Ampère equations if you were to Google this, you get something like the sort of standard one is minus ut times determinant of the Hessian to the 1 over n is equal to some positive function f. Right. So this is a different equation, right? I mean, we're looking at is something of the form UT is equal, I mean, if you take all the optimal transport stuff out of there, this is what we're looking at. And these don't always have nice properties. Several people have studied these, and I think the reason people like this one, because this is a homogeneous polynomial in the first order, you know, it's a first degree homogeneous polynomial in the Hessian. So it satisfies all this theory of like Caffarelli, Nierenberg, and Spruch, and so forth. But so this is clearly not a homogeneous polynomial. But it's a nice convex function, and what I'm going to show you today is I think this is really a natural way to study the parabolic Mongeau-Pierre equation. There are other reasons for studying this, but these are some of these solutions. People have studied this with a lot of different exponents here. You've looked at, you know, depending on different geometric applications, but some of the solutions don't have nice properties when you study this. Like they actually develop sort of ridges and things where this tends to smooth everything out a little bit nicer than these ones do. So the Gauss curvature flow, I don't know exactly, but it's something like n minus 2 over n or something here. There's some other n is equal to 1. That's Gauss curvature flow. Okay, I thought there was some curvature flow where you have some different one. I'm not actually sure about all of these, but yeah, there's other applications where you solve this sort of equations on manifolds, and some of them have nice properties, some of them don't. But we're going to focus on this one, and I'm going to explain hopefully why this is the right one to study, at least for optimal transport. So to explain that, I'm going to spend actually probably more time motivating why one would think of this result than actually proving it. Go back to a different sort of equation called the special Lagrangian equation. And these go back to Harvey and Lawson in 1982, and they showed that if you take a gradient graph of a function in R2n, that this is minimal, the minimal surface, codimension n, if and only if u satisfies what's called the special Lagrangian equation. That's the sum of the arctans of the eigenvalues, the Hessian of u, add up to a constant. Okay, so this is this was a big result in its own right, and you know it uses calibrations, and you know these are absolutely volume minimizing surfaces, so they're not just minimal surfaces in that they the mean curvature. It's not just that the mean curvature vanishes. They showed further that the mean curvature actually satisfies something in terms of this value theta, and that's H is given by, so you have the submanifold. It's in Rn, and you can think of this as IRn, so it's in complex space. And you always have this J map. So J is, this is a complex structure. So J, if you have a Lagrangian manifold, the J takes tangent vectors and it takes them to normal vectors. So this is going to be a normal vector, and you just look at the gradient of theta along this manifold. So theta is this function here. You take the gradient of this and you rotate it, and that's going to be your mean curvature. So You can also read from this that the mean curvature vanishes if and only if theta is constant. And in fact, more generally, this holds in if, and I'm not going to talk about the details of this too much, but if x is a Calabi-Yau manifold, then an L, some Lagrangian submanifold, is contained in X, then you can define this theta. I'm not going to talk about that, but just tell you that the same ideas hold. You can define theta, and L is special Lagrangian and minimal if and only if the gradient of theta is equal to zero. Yeah, you can. You just have to, it just has to be strictly C-convex, uniformly C-convex, yeah. I mean, this is a natural one to start out. The idea is you're starting out, you're not, at least in this case, you're starting out mapping all the points to themselves, and then you're going to follow along the flow, see where these points go. And again, to make our life easy, just assume this is on the sphere. So this was in 1982, and then a variety of other people have studied a related sort of special Lagrangian type equation. So just to put a couple of names, Mealy, who was a Harvey student, and then Hitchin studied this equation, and Yost and Sheen and myself looked at different properties of this equation. So if you take x and then gradient u of x contained in Rn cross Rn, but we're going to take a different metric with metric h is equal to so you have a, this is also written as dx dy sometimes. So it's a pseudo-Riemannian metric, pseudo-Euclidean, I guess. And so it has n positive directions and negative directions. So this is a minimal surface, meaning the mean curvature vanishes. And in fact, it's maximal. I mean, in terms of volume, but technically it's a minimal surface because the mean curvature vanishes. If and only if the satisfies the Mongen pair type equation. The lambda j eigenvalues of the Hessian. So I put these next to each other because they're analogs of each other. One's a pseudo-Euclidean case. The other's a Euclidean case. And then to sort of fill in this stuff, what happens more generally might not be so clear, but just to mention some algebra, which is not really crucial, but just to give you an idea. Complex numbers are, of course, R plus IR, and there's these things called the double numbers, which are R plus tau R. So I squared is equal to minus 1, tau squared is equal to 1. So you can create an algebra using this. And it turns out, for a lot of reasons, this metric here is the natural metric associated to this algebra. If you look at R2n with this algebra, then there's this metric associated to it. I'm not going to go into why that's true. And a lot of ideas carry over. Things like almost everything, pretty much everything you can do with complex geometry, you have, Kähler, Hermitian, holomorphic, Calabi, all these things, all these sort of complex geometry ideas, you can get at, or you can, there's analogs of this with these double numbers. And I'll just say, so see Harvey Lawson. Harvey Lawson posted a paper this summer. I want to say that they certainly didn't invent all this stuff. There's a lot of this, there's a lot of different notations for this, and a lot of different literatures and physics and algebra and a variety of things where this comes up. But they did a nice job of sort of like bringing it all together and sort of unifying and saying that this is actually all this stuff holds in a nice way. Okay, so in order to get into the optimal transport, so this is a work with Yinghan Kim and Robert McCann, and I guess we put pen here because it's just coming out. So given rho and rho bar and C, which satisfies A, I think just we need A. A2 is the important one. Then X, T of X, contained in M cross M with metric H, and then I'll write down this thing just to show you that it's explicit. Rho of X, rho bar of X bar, determinant of Cij. So we take this metric. And so this, Kim and McCann a few years ago had noticed that this, taking this cost function on the product, taking the derivatives of this cost function, one in the x direction, one in the one in this direction, gives you a nice metric. And that has a lot of nice properties which are important to curvature. And then we were able to show that by adding this factor here, this conformal factor, this is maximal, so it's a minimal surface, if and only if. So it's the same scenario as here. If and only if, two things in it, not quite the optimal transport, but certainly includes the optimal transport. One is that T pulls back rho bar to rho. And the other is that T is equal to a cost exponential of gradient U locally, at least locally. So in particular, condition on, oh, so yeah, U is a C-convex. I mean, you have to be able to find it. So you use some C-convex. And it's locally defined. So in particular, if T solves the optimal transport for a rho and rho bar. So you can see, actually, the special case is you take something like rho is equal to uniform density on some omega, rho bar is equal to uniform density on some other region. Say they have the same size in Rn. Then what you get is H is equal to precisely this metric which was studied before, this one here. And so that if you get a map from here to here, which is an optimal map, in this case it's going to be unique. You look at the gradient, or you look at the graph of the optimal map, and that's going to be a minimal surface in this sense. is going to satisfy the potential is going to satisfy the Monge-Ampere equation. Okay, so I have these all up here so that they visually look related. And now I'm going to talk about the parabolic versions of these things. So first of all, to get a parabolic version of this, you just take ut is equal to, this is sum of the arctans of the eigenvalues. So this is just this function theta. And so if this is a constant function, then u is just going to be translating, the gradient's not going to be moving at all. So this is going to be parabolic. Special Lagrangian equation. And the thing is that you have, if you take gamma t, it's x gradient u t of x, you take a solution of this with t, then gamma moves by mean curvature flow. And it's going to try to find, of course, what it's going to do is try to find a constant theta. If you find a constant theta, then you're at a special Lagrangian submanifold. So it's going to start out with a variable theta here, and then you move by mean curvature flow, and it's going to take you to some constant. I mean, that's not proven in every case. There are cases when this works. And so there's something else going on here, and that's that it's actually called Lagrangian mean curvature flow. And Lagrangian mean curvature flow is a really nice thing that happens only when you have a Calabi-Yau manifold. If you just have a general complex manifold and you try to run some sort of mean curvature flow, you actually don't expect that the Lagrangian condition is preserved along the mean curvature flow. So it's kind of a really nice thing that you can take one potential function and describe the mean curvature flow. Right? You're not solving a system, you're solving one scalar. And you can solve the mean curvature flow using just methods here. So the same thing holds over here, at least in Rn, in the simplest form. You see the same thing. Ut is equal to the sum of the natural logs of the eigenvalues, and the same holds. You take a gradient graph of this function, it moves by mean curvature flow with respect to this other metric. Okay, but it's not quite, so something goes a little bit weird here. And what happens is, so this, in this case, you have to have a Calabi-Yau manifold. You know, when you're talking about general closed manifolds, if you want the mean curvature flow to preserve the Lagrangian condition, then it has to be a Calabi-Yau. So it turns out in this case over here, in general, and I mean, I haven't actually found a case where it's actually satisfies. Harvey and Lawson give an analog for the what should be a Calabi-Yau. They come up with this D Hermitian Ricci flat Kähler manifold. You have these things, and these are sort of the analog of Calabi-Yau. So this metric is not, I'll just call it D Calabi-Yau. That's not what they call it, but it's not the precise analog. So this things have to be set up very precisely for this to be a Calabi-Yau, but that means that we don't expect mean curvature flow to come from a potential. So if you start out with a cost exponential of a map, and you know in this metric here you have m and m, and you just take some t, the graph of some function, you start to run mean curvature flow on this, you don't expect it to actually stay a cost exponential. When you don't, and it, I mean, I actually don't know that. It's really hard to show either way. And since a lot of the things hold, you know, a lot of things carry over from the Calabi-Yau case, I would find it very, very, very unlikely that if you run mean curvature flow in this case, you would actually get. A flow which actually comes from one scalar, from one potential U. I don't expect that to happen. And so the mean curvature flow is hard to study. I mean, it's a great geometric thing. Study mean curvature flow, but what we did instead is we wrote down the most obvious scalar equation, which we would hope would be mean curvature flow. Doesn't seem like it is, but we just write down this natural-looking equation. It is just the natural log of a determinant dt minus natural log of rho plus natural log of rho bar. So that's sort of how we come. That's geometrically how we come to this equation versus, say, ut is equal to determinant of the Hessian to some power, something like that. So this is the Euclidean case. This is the pseudo-Euclidean case. And these things are closely linked. This just has this extra business here. And we put the extra business, we don't expect to get Calabi, or we don't expect to get that, but this is sort of the closest thing. So I'll say some more words about what this flow means, or so this is, it's sort of, I'll use the word orthogonal, which isn't completely precise. But to the standard, and I say standard, what I mean is on the space of volume-preserving maps, or let's say volume-preserving. If you start it with, so the standard, or the classical version of optimal transport is you start with just looking at the T's which preserve the volume, which send this volume to this, or send this measure to this other measure. So I mean, you only consider T pushes forward rho to rho bar. But what we're doing is we're not starting out with the T which is preserving the measure. We're starting out with the T which does it whatever it wants, but it starts out as a cost exponential. And then we're going to flow towards the solution in this sort of orthogonal looking way. So what I mean, and so you have this big, huge infinite dimensional manifold. Think of this as all maps. I mean, without putting a real topology on it, but just you have a whole bunch of maps from M to M. Then you have this submanifold of these, which is this might be the maps which preserve. Which preserve a measure, so what happens is that if you just look at this, and then you start here, and you can always find something in this class. If you have two measures, you can use methods of Moser or other methods just to go and find something here, and this is computationally, but also you know it's just interesting from pure point. You can always find something here and then follow a gradient flow. And I say always, I mean, it hasn't been, to my knowledge, I don't know precisely what conditions are needed to this. But you start on this thing and you flow towards some optimal map. And then there's this other space, and the other space is T is equal to the cost exponential of a gradient U. So that's this other space. And the fundamental thing, I think, in the Brenyi-McCann theory is that there's one thing right here, right? There's one intersection in between this this space of volume preserving maps and then this space of cost exponentials. So what we're doing here is we're starting somewhere here, and we're starting on this manifold of cost exponentials, and then we're going to move towards here. So the orthogonality, I mean, I can make it a little bit more precise. It is somewhat precise. There is a Hodge-Helmholtz type decomposition. And that's it's only shown along this submanifold. So take t is equal to some cost exponential of du, and then we only require this to be true locally. So this local condition is interesting because if you have manifolds, I won't go into this too much today, but if you have manifolds of topology, you can actually find things in here which are local but not global. Those have the geometry of optimal transport maps, but they're not actually minimizers of the cost functional. But they look locally like optimal transport maps. So you can start out with some map like this, and then you define a vector field. V is going to be C. So this is this inverted mixed derivative. So you're assuming A2, that this is non-degenerate. We should start with a one form. Eta. Eta is equal to eta I dx I, summed up on, and this is on M. So you see upper I j, so this is at x, and then we take the vector, so dx j at x bar. So what this is you have a manifold, say this is one copy of the manifold, another copy of the manifold. You have this point going here, and then you look at basically all this is the tangent space of the deformation of maps. You look at where it's defined. You take a form over here, but then because this is non-degenerate, it's kind of like you're flattening it with respect to this Kim-McCann metric. I think that's what's going on. You're flattening V comes from flattening the form down here with respect to the Kim-McCann metric. Flattening. Okay, this is the inverse metric. Right, so you can always there's a map between one forms and did I mean sharping? Is that what you meant? Or? Oh, okay. So yeah, you're raising and lower the indices. There's always if you have a one form and a non-degenerate metric, you can always define a vector field. Right? So what it's doing is you have a one form here. You look at its components and this defines a vector field over here. So this is really the tangent space to the deformation of a map T. So we're going to look and we're going to deform T, see what happens. So what we do is we let Gij be, and then I put this funny factor, which looks like that if you already have the right metric, or if you already have the solution, but you don't have to be at the solution. And then we have a different power here, which is a different story. So you take this metric on M, and you find that deformations of T by V are volume preserving if and only if d star of eta is equal to 0. So you start here, you look at a form over here, and what I mean is it pulls back the, what t pulls back from rho bar is the same thing, it doesn't change. So you can change things in certain, you know, some way, but you don't change the major preserving aspect of this. And so they are, and let's say cos x preserving. So if and only if what you'd expect, d eta is 0. So this gives you that harmonic forms are the only thing they're going to tell you the directions which you can deform the vector, deform a map which is going to be pulling back the same volume form, and it's going to still rise as a cost exponential locally. And this is true, I don't know if it's true in other places on this big space, but it's true anywhere along here. Okay, so I mentioned this because this is, I mean, it's sort of the picture here of our orthogonal flows, and also we're actually going to use this metric in the end. So here's the proof. And I won't say too much about the regularity because it's essentially the same as other proofs of the regularity. So so you start out with this ut is equal to theta, which is equal to natural log of the determinant of dt minus natural log rho plus natural log of rho bar. Then ut of 0, or theta of 0, you know, we can set this to anything we want, but just if we just set it to be 0, this is, the determinant is determinant of 1, so this vanishes, and you just get minus natural log rho of x plus natural log rho bar of x, and this is, it's bounded by something, right? Bounded by something. And then, since theta t is we're linearizing theta, that's what's going on, so you use this elliptic, you have this elliptic equation, or this parabolic equation, theta satisfies a maximum principle. So the fact that it's already bounded at 0 means that theta has to stay bounded. Theta stays bounded, and then in particular we can control this. We have these things which are controlled. We're assuming these are controlled, so this is controlled. And then, so that control implies by the stay away, so this is using the stay away property, that the derivatives of, well, at least up to the fourth order, that's what we're going to use, of the cost are preserved, or are controlled. So we have uniform control over all the derivatives here, and then we can just repeat the elliptic MTW argument. And I'm not going to do that. But those of you who've gone from elliptic to parabolic know that pretty much you can do a lot of things where you have a maximum principle argument for an elliptic equation, you repeat it with a UT on one side of it, you can get a little bit of work, you can pretty much reproduce the same thing. And that's what we do. You can show that so Wij is equal to Uij plus Cij. W11t minus Lw11 is bounded by minus delta, some MTW constant, times the size of this to the 2 plus 1 over n minus 1, plus some large constant, power of W squared, something like this. the same MCW type argument. And then this tells you that U is bounded, and or Hessian of U is bounded, and then you apply the theory of Krylov, and you can get the C2 alpha estimates on U, and you can get the time derivatives, and you can use the shower theory and all this, and you get a long time existence and regularity. So the only thing that's left is the convergence. And so we looked at Lieberman, the book Lieberman, and so he talked about, you have some sort of operator, some sort of parabolic. We know now that this is this L. Well, once we have this all this regularity for W, we can actually, we can say that this linearized operator is uniformly elliptic. So this here is a uniformly parabolic situation, and it has, so L, I won't write it out, but it's got, the first things are the linearized determinant part of it, and then you have these three other terms, which are combinations of cost functions, third derivatives of cost functions and things. But so you can look there and try to figure out, does this give you a Harnack inequality? Yeah, I think so, but it's actually it's hard to actually go precisely through and figure out what precisely is the Harnack inequality. Like if you're just to read Lieberman's book, because the proofs are very involved and they're very general. So we looked at this, and then we looked at this thing, and it turns out that L is in fact equal to lambda times G. Lambda times the plus Beltrami operator for G. So this, there's a reason why this is appearing here. It's, with respect to this metric, you have this linearization is actually basically the plus with respect to this metric. So that means we can repeat the Liao Harnack argument. So at this conference, I don't know if this is familiar to everybody, but it's not really a hard. I mean, you can write it down in like two or three pages. It's direct. If you have this sort of a thing, if you have theta satisfy some sort of lambda which is controlled times the Laplace with respect to some metric, the derivative of the metric controlled, then you can repeat this argument and you can get a Harnack estimate. So this gives you a Harnack estimate, which is what you need for exponential convergence. So it really follows exactly the same argument. So we included that because I think it's a little bit nicer than using this really, really general theory that holds for all sorts of wild equations, which is hard to actually track down the coefficient or track down the bounds. But you can see what the bounds are in this argument. So you get something like, Ft is equal to, if Ft is lambda Laplace d theta, and this thing's controlled, or f is a positive function, then the sup of f, fixed sum x, or fixed sum t1, is less than some constant depending on t1, t2, times f of inf f at some later time t2. So then, since this theta doesn't have a first order, a zeroth order term, we can just bound, so theta has to be, if it has, we can bound the sup by some time by the inf at a later time. So it has to converge. and we can actually get good control on the exponent. So theta, again, theta was this. Just remind you what theta was. Theta was this, is equal to this difference between the natural log of the determinant and what should be happening as far as. So when this goes to zero, you have an optimal transport map. And it always, I mean, I guess there's a little bit of an argument to say that U stays C-convex, but that's not too hard. U stays C-convex, so it has to happen in the end of G at the optimal transport.